There is a sixth dimension beyond that which is known to reasonable man. It is a dimension as vast as Gallagher's talent and as timeless as when Justin met Kelly. It is the middle ground between good taste and terrible judgment, between flops and fiascos, and it lies between the pit of puny man-animal's fears and the summit of Oogie Love's knowledge. This is the dimension of grudging toleration. It is an area which we call Nathan Raven's Happy Cast. Listeners, and welcome to this most perfect episode of Nathan Raven's Happy Cast. I, alas, am not Nathan Raven. I am instead Clint Worthington. I am a film and TV critic for Consequence of Sound, but you can call me Catwoman.
Hey there, Hulkamaniacs. This is Nathan Raven from Nathan Raven's Happy Place and Nathan Raven's Happy Cast. Oh God, that's fucking brutal on my lungs. Oh God, how can he continue to talk like that? No wonder he went insane and became an evil force from the universe.
I mean, just that sheer power of that mustache maintained his power.
Oh Christ, and that mullet, that balding mullet. It's a thing of beauty and a joy forever.
Emptiness in the front, party in the back. It's all party. It's a mullet, but it's all party. And anyway, as you could possibly glean from our terrible impressions. Of things. We're going to talk about Catwoman and some Hulk Hogan related media from the 1980s, as is our wont. But it's a real superheroic episode of Happy Cast because we're once again engaging in our mission to talk about new releases that came out like a month ago. First was Mandy last time, and now we're going to talk about Venom, the phenomenon, if you will, that is a weird like 90s superhero movie that somehow found its way into 2018 theaters.
A little bit of an 80s movie as well, and it's worth pointing out that the day that this drops will be the day of the election.
Yes, so please vote. Please
Holy
vote.
Shit. And write in Donald Trump. Every single time. That's the only way to make America great again. But in honor of you know, one of the most important elections in American history, we're going to be talking about stupider bullshit than usual.
Yes.
This episode. This will be a particularly silly, particularly ephemeral, particularly irrelevant episode on a very, very important day in American history.
Right, we need you to preserve all your brain energy for the sophisticated thing that you need to do today. Research your candidates, find your polling place. If you're in Illinois and you're not registered, you can register day of. I promise. So go to your polling place, poll, like vote, please. The fate of our country depends on you, and we do not have Hulk Hogan's rock and wrestling team to save us.
I endorse all of the good candidates.
All the ones that are not bad.
Exactly.
Or least bad, at least. You know, this is what we usually do. We talk about a new movie, and then we talk about an old crappy movie related to it. And then a third segment that's just whatever. We are guestless this episode. It's just going to be the two of us. Just an intimate evening of superhero-dom. But we can't do it without the help of our lovely patrons, because we do have a Patreon. It's patreon.com/NathanRavensHappyCast. I am pleased to report we actually made our goal of one new patron for every new episode of the show. So I really want to give a big thanks to Paul. Be cool like Paul. We've been so blessed by like all the great new patrons we've had, and we really want to keep it up. It really helps keep the light on. We're finally sort of solvent in terms of Nathan actually at least like makes single digit dollars after paying me every month.
I think I was down $10 this month, but only $10 or $20 away from me being up slightly for an episode.
There we go. So yes, if you want to help us out, go to patreon.com/NathanRavensHappyCast. We try to give you bonus audio and whatnot whenever we can. So yeah, thanks, Paul. Thanks to everybody who is still around. We love you all so much. Let's just get this party started, shall we? Let's move on to scalding hot takes. And so, like a turd in the wind, we move on to Scalding Hot Takes. Venom, the movie that no one asked for and yet everybody watched, because it somehow had like a really big box office return, which is baffling to me.
It had the Bafo box office. I had a kind of a weird response to this, where I was looking forward to Venom because he's kind of an interesting character. You know, I sort of I like to call him the pantheon of Hot Topic superstars.
Yeah.
They were the superheroes that you, the supervillains and the anti-heroes that you found, you know, and then
the sort of Todd McFarlane school.
And posters, yeah, totally. Deadpool, Venom is a big
Spawn.
One. Punisher. Kind of badass. And you know, he's kind of the genre of, you know, Wolverine and Deadpool and Punisher have all gotten R-rated sort of quote-unquote badass cinematic vehicle. And yeah. I think people were really hoping that that's what Venom would be as well, particularly with the insane box office that Deadpool and Deadpool 2 and Logan all had. And I think the big difference is those movies all knew what the fuck they were doing.
Yeah.
So they were very good, and they implemented this darkness and this violence and this graphic element that you don't generally find in big superhero movies. They could fucking do that.
They all managed to be the same movie for their entire runtime.
Oh, fucking A, man. And the difference with Venom is it doesn't fucking know what it's doing. And it doesn't want to go with the R rating because it's really bad. And keeping out your target audience of, disgruntled, unwell 12-year-olds and 13-year-olds with violent fantasies, like, that's just not a good idea. But when I read that Venom was getting overwhelmingly negative, almost Catwoman-like reviews, I had this insane thought where I thought, oh, I guess it'll flop at the box office and we won't see any more Venom.
Were we wrong?
I was fucking wrong. It ended up being a big, big hit. It's grossed over $500 million. It's doubled A Star Is Born's box office tick.
Oh,
it should be noted, however, that, you know, they're slightly different movies. As I've written on the site over and over again, I'm a slouchy, maladjusted 12-year-old and the body of a slouchy, maladjusted 42-year-old. So I was excited about Venom. I was excited. I wanted to see him eat people's faces. He's a superhero who eats people's faces. Like, supervillains, anti-hero, who knows? He complicates the whole idea of morality anywhere.
Right.
And I gotta say, I had this bifurcated experience where I thought, wow, that was a really shitty, bad movie that's not even trying to be good, and I really enjoyed it for the most part. How was your experience, Clint?
It's so weird. My experience basically varied depending on what act of the movie I was watching.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The first one is this overlong, confusing, dumb little like corporate espionage thriller / Korean monster movie. The third act is the typical sort of superhero bullshit where like we just arbitrarily decide that we need to save the world from the scheme that's been in the background this entire time, and like nothing is set up, the fight scene's a mess. But there's this fun second act in the middle where it's just Tom Hardy doing Upgrade, even though Upgrade is the better Venom movie. Let's like get that out of the way. Yeah, like it was at least fun to see like Tom Hardy just get to do his weird New York accent and like flail his arms around and talk to himself, and like that kind of stuff was fun.
I loved the Venom element of the motion picture Venom. I'm wondering why it was like 10% of the actual fucking movie.
Right.
I just want to see a giant, crazy black monster with a giant tongue do crazy shit and eat people's faces. I read about this in my review, but I'm so, so, so tired of superhero movies that take an entire goddamn act to deal with newspaper business.
Yes.
Newspapers, online, the media. I don't fucking care about any of this shit. You know, like I said in my review, like, this is not, you know, all the President's Men. This is not Spotlight. This is not an expose. That's just some stupid bullshit that is distracting from the core of your movie, which is a superhero or a supervillain behaving in a superhero or a supervillainously fashion. You're just wasting time and batting time. And I could not have fucking cared about that. I also could not care less about the corporation.
The Life Corporation?
I mean, we just fucking watched Venom and Catwoman, and both of them are like, oh, aren't you excited about the bad guys who is a villainous business person? It's like, no, that's no. fucking boring. That's boring as hell. Give me Doc Ock. Give me, you know, the Joker. Give me Killer Croc. He's a goddamn mutated right. crocodile, for fuck's sakes. He is inherently a better villain and a better character than somebody who's just kind of greedy.
Yeah, and especially like the different class of villains we get, which we'll get into Catwoman's villains later, but we have Riz Ahmed, who's a fantastic actor. But
yeah,
like
he's fantastic in Four Lions, one of my favorite performances of the past decade.
Right, and like Nightcrawler and all kinds of stuff. And so it's weird to see him play this like faux Elon Musk type, who like doesn't yes. know what kind of movie he's in.
Oh yeah, 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 yeah.
Only Tom Hardy knows what movie he's in.
And one of the things that I loved about his character is that there's this real Jekyll and Hyde type quality to it. I kind of, in my article, I said that it was sort of like watching a version of Little Shop of Horrors, in which the protagonist and Audrey 2 were occupying the same body. Yeah. And I mean, it makes sense that this was directed by the same guy who did Zombieland, because when this is a dark comedy, kind of a body horror thing, sort of rooted partially in comic books and partially in horror, it's really clever. It's really fun. It knows what it is doing. It's vulgar and tacky and enjoyable. And when it's being a superhero movie, it's really fucking bad and it's going through the motions. And it really feels like, you know, the first week, the director just kind of assembled the cast and crew and said, like, I've looked at the dailies. There's no chance of this movie ever being good. So don't try that hard. Like, if you want to go for like a like B minus is what we're shooting for, we're probably not even going to get there. But you want to talk about Michelle, Academy, a four-time Academy Award nominee, Michelle Williams, in this motion picture?
I'll try. It's just the most thankless, blank kind of performance.
Well, who does she play?
Oh, she plays She-Venom. I don't even remember like her name. Anne Sebring? I don't know.
She's a fancy lawyer lady who has lots of important documents.
She's Eddie Brock's girlfriend.
Who's a loser and he's pathetic.
He has beaded bracelets.
I mean, the other thing too is like they establish like a hotshot investigative journalist with a high-powered attorney fiance, but he's also a loser who can't do anything right and is a big dummy. It doesn't really seem to make a whole lot of sense. I mean, I like that he was a jerk. Not to skip too far ahead, but
yeah,
the one moment in this motion picture that made me think, you know what? I kind of fucking like Venom. I might see this again in the right circumstance, aka being really high. Yeah. I might see a sequel to this, and that was the moment, pretty deep into it, when Venom says to Eddie Brock, who he has kind of a weird, crazy BDSM sadomasochistic relationship with, he goes, "You know, Eddie, on my planet, I'm kind of a loser. Yeah. That's why I want to stay here." And I said, "Oh, I fucking love that. I love the idea that Venom, an evil alien symbiote from outer space, was a schmuck and didn't get laid in high school and had a bunch of dorky passions and was really into D&D, and he kind of likes being on this other planet just because he's more, by default, more impressive, more
he's
special,
a big fish in a little pond,
more super total. And I like Venom. I think that is like a really fun character. They've got a great dynamic. But yeah, why do they make us wait so long for Venom? And why is every other element of this movie so incredibly arbitrary? I mean, I was looking on Wikipedia, and they were talking about how Michelle Williams is really into the idea of doing a spinoff as She-Venom.
Yeah.
Oh, and like I said in my review, like, there are the average video of a hostage delivering ransom demands has more energy and enthusiasm and conviction than Michelle Williams' performance here. Like, it looks like they had a fucking gun to her head that they had to digitally edit out to get her to mumble and sleepwalk through this horrible, horrible movie. And she's fucking great, and she's terrible here. Even more terrible, even more bewildering, Jenny Slate!
Jenny Slate.
What the fuck is superstar comedian? She was in one of the goddamn Elvin and the Chipmunks, but actually that might explain what she's doing in this movie. And that she was the female love interest in one of the Elvin and the Chipmunks movies. Because, like, what? What happened? Like, if she had been brainwashed by an actual supervillain who forced her to appear in this movie against her will, and she did not remember any of it, like as soon as the film wrapped. That would make more sense to me than Jenny Slate read the script and said, I really need to play the scientist lady. It's very important for me to be involved in this project. Like, that made no sense. And everybody here is so bad. Even people who I love in literally every other context, which is Jenny Slate, which is Michelle Williams, which is the bad guy. It's fascinatingly down market to me. I kind of felt like this is a day and age in which you can make an A-list Venom movie. Like, you can try and go for, you know, like a Thor Ragnarok or a Black Panther or Deadpool 2. Try and do something big and ambitious. And instead, they went cheap and tacky. And I was reminded of, you know, Canon actually owned the rights to Marvel and a lot of their properties in the 1990s. It was amazing. If you read the Schottenheimer has a great history of Marvel that I can't recommend highly enough. But they were on such hard times that a fucking B-list baseball card company, if I'm not mistaken, Fleers, owned them. And Canon, you know, they fucking made Captain America. And I felt like if Canon had maintained rights to, you know, Spider-Man and Venom and all of these guys and had continued to exist into the aughts, or the teens rather, like that's what we would have gotten. And that's part of why I'm like, holy shit, this is junky and weird and vulgar and bad. And then part of me is also like, holy shit, this is a lot of fun and goofy and vulgar and bad in a way that I kind of very much enjoy.
There's a lot of weird, fun, badness in this. Like, I also like the idea that the way they recharacterize Venom in a Spider-Man-less universe is that he's an alien who's just kind of a loser, and he finds kinship in someone else who's supposed to be kind of a loser, and they like just are these misfits who find kinship in one another. I wish that it actually read in the movie apart from that one line.
I
wish when they like have the evil Venom, which feels redundant, like in Riz Ahmed, like I wish they had like a bit of a like more of a dynamic of like, oh, this motherfucker, like really, you're gonna try to stop me, why? Or like,
well,
looking down on
you're,
him,
you're referring to Riot.
Yeah, Riot,
which is a name that again screams for Hot Topic merchandising opportunities. And one of the problems with Venom,
I'm a big fan of his fest. Yeah.
That's true. One of the big problems with Venom is he is a sinewy, muscular, perpetually moving black blob. It's very easy for him to just kind of disappear. It's very easy to him kind of be camouflaged. It's a little bit like sort of like the Predator and Predator 2 when it was camouflaged, where it's like you have this really cool, weird looking dude, but unless he's like running around in the sunshine, it's kind of hard to make him out. And again, there are just weird things where they establish that Venom is this crazy, face-eating, evil alien from outer space. And then at a certain point, it's like, you know what? I kind of like you guys. I'm going to fight to save humanity now.
As long as I get to occasionally eat us a few bad people.
Oh, God. I kind of enjoy that. But it's also fucking arbitrary, and it feels like they had a bunch of scripts of this and they'll just kind of toss them together and hope that it made sense, and it kind of doesn't.
And to go back to Jenny Slate too, like I feel like, yes, she makes some terrible career choices, but I feel like these big budget movies are just there to like subsidize her rom-coms with Gillian Robespierre, so like her obvious child and Landlines and stuff. That's the stuff where she shines. Here she's just like, because I remember in the first trailer she was the person giving most of the exposition, and she keeps calling it a symbiote, and that made the internet blow up for a second. So like, they very clearly redub her in the movie to say symbiote, because that's one of the weird controversies the internet focused on, of all the things to focus on in Venom.
Well, and the thing that's kind of crazy, too, is you're kind of talking about Venom as kind of an evil Spider-Man or a morally ambiguous Spider-Man. So he's kind of a bit of a ripoff as it is, you know, with the crazy tongue, with the attitude, with the extremism. I don't feel like we're fucking giving anything away. This movie ends with a mid-credit sequence in which we discover Venom's Venom. The knockoff of the knockoff of the knockoff of the knockoff, which is a character named Carnage, who is more insane, who is a serial killer, who is played by the wonderful Woody Harrelson in a carrot top wig.
Yes.
And seeing this horrible, horrible cameo from like this nightmarish, you know, literally they made like a Marvel character just for people who were in reform school for like torturing animals. They're basically Carnages for you. All of the good characters are for everybody else, but like Carnage is just a sick, disgusting piece of shit. That's just for you. And seeing it, I'm like, oh my God, that is so shitty and so dumb. And I'm going to enjoy the fuck out of seeing Carnage and Riot and Venom all interact.
And She Venom.
And the inevitable, and She Venom, exactly. The mere word She Venom should not be uttered around Michelle Williams. She is a woman with dignity.
She is.
And this film is just an assault, a never ending assault on her dignity. And the idea of her starring in a spinoff as a She Venom is even more ridiculous, even more, I don't know, it's funnier than anything in the actual movie itself.
Very true. But she does offer my favorite line in the picture, which is after all is said and done and they think Venom has died, or she thinks Venom has died, and they're sitting on a stoop sort of patching up the relationship, and Academy Award winner Michelle Williams puts her hand on Eddie Brock's shoulder and says, with all the acting force she can muster, "I'm really sorry about Venom." And I couldn't believe my fucking ears, and it was great. I wish the movie was more like that. I wish that first act with the incongruous like cuts to like, did we really need to see like several scenes of like Riot wandering its way around the world trying to make its way to Riz Ahmed, to the lab that has a bunch of Venoms in it already? Like, it was so weird.
Yeah. But it was interesting, too, just kind of because they are doing different things in this. They're kind of playing with the body horror element. Kind of the ideal version of this to me would be a 1980s David Cronenberg motion picture.
Yeah.
With Jeff Goldblum in the lead as Venom. I think that would have been an interesting take. I was actually watching this. I was reminded that I have a friend who's a screenwriter, and at one point he was going to work on a Venom movie that was going to be directed by Josh Trank, who did that big movie that I really liked.
Fant4stic.
No, come on, the one before that with the
Chronicle.
Chronicle, yeah. Fantastic Four, and Fantastic Four, which I liked a lot more than other people did, but that definitely had an element of body horror to it. Mm-hmm. And I feel like Josh Trank could have given it a darker energy. It could have brought more personality to it. This needed a fucking auteur, and it did not get that from Ruben Fleischer. But again, I like Zombieland a lot, but Gangsters Who Out, which he directed, was just hot garbage, and kind of showed that he wasn't good at directing these kind of big, splashy, mega productions. And I think it had 30 minutes or less.
Mm-hmm. Oh, just a right.
Hot garbage of a motion picture as well.
Yeah.
So you need a Taika Waititi. You need, a Ryan Coogler. You need somebody who knows what the fuck they're doing. You need somebody who directed the John Wick movie. You do not need the guy who did Gangster Squad.
You need Dennis Dugan.
Yeah, exactly. It needed a personality. It did not necessarily get that.
Yeah, that's unfortunate, which is a shame because like we're dancing around like the main appeal, which is Tom fucking Hardy doing that weird ass accent. Like, I feel like this movie's the culmination of decades of people telling Tom Hardy, yeah, try that accent. Let's see what happens.
which incredibly aggressive accent are you talking about? Are you talking about the Venom accent? Or are you talking about the Eddie Brock accent?
I'm talking about Eddie Brock. You know, I'm a reporter.
Gonna grab a Stromboli over there, got a Queens Boulevard, you know what I'm saying, man?
Yeah, I'm a guy from Queens in San Francisco for some reason.
How did you feel about this being a film theoretically kind of in the Marvel Universe that does not have any... Oh, Todd McFarlane was one of the creators of Venom.
Of course he was.
Makes a whole lot of sense.
What were you asking?
I was asking about it being kind of a Marvel movie that does not have any connections to other Marvel movies. And I guess theoretically, isn't the idea that this kind of exists in the same universe as Homecoming, or is that misinformation? Is that fake news?
Well, big question. Did you stick around after the credits?
Oh my God. No, I did not.
Okay. Because that's the best part, because actually after the credits they show
Carnage. I saw the Carnage part.
Yeah, that's the mid credits, but then after the credits it cuts to meanwhile in another universe, and it's a clip from the actually great looking Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. So I think this establishes that yes, this is an entirely different Spider-Man-less universe. Which is why you can get away with Venom like looking like a bad Spider-Man, but without having to have Spider-Man there in the first place.
Oh, that's funny, because when I watched this movie in a theater where I was literally the only person there, it felt very strange. I felt like all the time in the world, that Twilight Zone episode with Burgess Meredith. And John Mulaney's two lines in the trailer for Spider-Man Into the Multiverse, Into the Spider-Verse, rather, they made me laugh substantially more than the entirety, and gave me more entertainment than the entirety of Venom did.
Yeah, that clip from the end of the movie is the best part of Venom, from an entirely different movie. So there is that. As far as I know, Venom exists in a world without Spider-Man, but it's also kind of like the movie we're going to talk about next, in which Catwoman takes place in a universe without Batman.
That is true, but who needs Batman when you have Benjamin Bratt as handsome police officer?
When you have Bratman. Bratman forever.
You do have Bratman, that's true. You have Bratman forever.
Yes, indeed. Episode title, maybe? Do we have any more thoughts on Venom? Maybe we should wrap that up then.
No, I think we're good. Cool.
Are you sticking around for Venom 2? Even more Venom?
Oh, fuck yes.
All right, cool.
Even more venomous.
The phenomenon continues. Anyway, moving on. It's Control Nathan and Clint time. Nathan, what were our options this week?
Oh, sweet blessed Lord. Well, we had Batman Forever, a.k.a. Bratman Forever. That is the Joel Schumacher-directed horrible piece of shit Batman adaptation that people don't talk about.
Which one is worse, Batman Forever or Batman and Robin?
Batman and Robin, I think, is more fun just because it's more spectacularly bad. It really goes for it.
Yeah.
Whereas Batman Forever, I feel like, is still kind of tethered to a vision of Batman that maybe is not unbelievably terrible and not incredibly cheesy and campy and let's do the Joel Schumacher version one time better. But it looked like the readers they chose not to sanction our buffoonery.
Oh, alas,
because they did not choose that one. We also had Spider-Man 3.
Introduced Venom's last hurrah
as a film character, and it's a measure of how forgettable that movie is that I literally don't remember anything about it.
Yeah.
I don't remember anything about and Topher Grace once vomited alongside me in a plane. So I remember Topher Grace and I pay very close attention to everything that he does. I don't remember a fucking, I think he had blonde hair or something.
I remember
Sandman.
Yeah,
he had blonde hair and he was a photographer and he was like very cocky and very obnoxious.
And he was jealous of Peter Parker.
I don't remember anything about how Venom looked, except that he wasn't anywhere as nightmarish or as creepy, as kind of intense as here. And then the final one was Catwoman, which I previously covered for my World of Flops. And that was the one that we chose. And I thought that was pretty appropriate because the world has changed substantially since 2004. but as with Venom and Catwoman, I felt like one of the main takeaways is these movies illustrate why you do not make movies out of secondary characters. You don't make movies out of villains, out of sidekicks, out of bad guys, out of antiheroes. This is kind of illustration why, you know, before the big explosion, you fucking stuck with Spider-Man and Batman and Superman.
These are movies that either existed before or exist in spite of the age of the cinematic universe, right? Like we said, Venom exists independent of Spider-Man. Catwoman is just its own thing. So it feels like such a weird throwback at such a weird era. And Catwoman came around at the same time as like things like Daredevil.
Yeah. Well, Elektra, I was thinking about that as well. It's like Elektra. It seems perverse to me that they went ahead and made an Electro movie before they made a Wonder Woman movie.
Yeah, exactly.
That seems very, very, very perverse. And with this, I guess, you know, it had been in development for a long time, dating back to when Michelle Pfeiffer was unbelievably amazing as Catwoman in Batman Returns. And I was kind of the ideal age for that performance, in that I was a very angry, surly juvenile delinquent with a very dark sense of humor. And it was such an iconic performance, so big, so shattering, so sexy, so dark, so iconic. And they really, really wanted to bring that back. And Daniel Waters, who wrote Heathers, who wrote Batman, or who co-wrote Batman Returns, he wrote a Catwoman script that was supposed to be very, 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 very dark. And as he tells it, he turned in his volume of that script the first weekend of Batman Forever. And Batman Forever made a fuck ton of money, which the studio interpreted as, oh, that's the direction that they want these characters to go. They want them to be silly. They want them to be campy. They want them to be family fun. They don't want it to be, you know, this kind of dark goth Sue and the Banshees iteration of it. So what happened was they threw out Dylan Waters' script. And yeah, I guess for a while there, they were going to have Ashley Judd talk for it. Nicole Kidman talked to it. And then it somehow ended up getting made with Academy Award winner Halle Berry as Catwoman. And holy fucking God, is she terrible in this motion picture.
Yeah, if Norbit had never been made, I think it would have been called the Catwoman rule. That infamous rule where actors who finally win their first Academy Award, their next movie is a pile of crap. Whether it's this, whether it's Norbit, whether it's Jupiter Ascending, even though there's a lot of stuff I love about Jupiter Ascending, especially Eddie Redmayne. But yeah, Catwoman is such a bizarre thing because it also just sort of takes the idea of Catwoman and perverts it to such a degree that it is entirely different from what it is before. Like, at least with Venom, the mechanics of Venom are still the same. It's still Eddie Brock with a symbiote in him that is murderous and villainous, and he sort of has this Jekyll and Hyde relationship with it. Whereas with Catwoman, there's a bit of a Jekyll and Hyde relationship between Patience Phillips, a person who's not a comic book character, and her Catwoman, where Catwoman in the comics is just a cat burglar with a gimmick. But Catwoman has mystical powers. And what are they, Nathan?
Well, basically, this is what they did. And I think Pitoff was the director of this.
Who's a visual effects guy who did a lot of Jean-Pierre Jeunet films, I think.
Yeah. Here's a guide if you're up your own ass. You go by one.
Yes. He sounds like a particularly terrible French taffy.
It feels like Pitoff. You know, he went to the studio and he had his big pitch. And he goes, here is my vision for a Catwoman movie. Now, we've talked about this. You know, we've worked on this. Nobody's been able to, crack the code. Here's my idea for a Catwoman movie. Kitty cat magic.
Yeah.
Kitty cat magic.
Kitty
Instead
cat
of
magic.
Being a conventional superhero movie, a supervillain movie, anti-hero movie, this will be a wacky comedy about a woman who gets kitty cat magic. And she has a magical experience with a kitty cat, and then she has special kitty cat powers.
Oh my God.
That's basically the sum of it. And they're like, holy shit, Pitoff, you're a genius. No wonder you only have one name. Here's $150 million. Please realize your vision of the world's biggest kitty cat magic movie.
Yes, I want to point out some of the cat power, some of the special magic powers that Patience Phillips gets that apparently are specific to cats. Being scared of birds, chasing spiders, the preternatural ability to tell off your boss. That's a thing that cats are really well known for.
Exactly.
Being really great at basketball.
You notice how none of them are unhappily employed. You never Indeed. See a cat that's... unless they're cast in the movie Catwoman. But I think most of those fuckers are CGI. So nothing to worry about there.
Yeah. Cats are really, really good at karate. And are really, really good at cracking whips.
Here's a question for you, my friend. Does this movie take place in the Uncle Drewniverse?
Perhaps...
Because this is a movie involving magical basketball playing skills.
Yes.
You know, they're not rooted in shoes as Uncle Drew, but they are, you know, she basically has these skills. She can get basketball. She's like, oh, I'm going to dribble. And oh my God, she turns into a one-woman Harlem Globetrotters.
But a sexy one who's twerking in front of Benjamin Bratt.
Yeah, so she's like, ooh, look how I can work my booty while playing basketball. Literally. 70 school children are watching 3.5 feet away. They're watching this basketball sex session that they're having. But I should point out how this incredibly, because my God, this is the scene that epitomizes why this movie is such an insane shit show. So yeah. There's a scene establishing that Benjamin Bratt is one of the good type of cops. He's visiting an elementary school and saying, yeah, that's why you got to be good and not kill anybody and, you know, don't profile African-Americans. And then Halle Berry shows up. She's like, oh, I'm so sorry. Here's a coffee. She's like, hey, everybody, let's go outside and play basketball on the school porch, and this dude who just shows up because he's a cop, and this woman who, again, doesn't have any children, isn't having like an official relationship, so she shows up there, and children, as they want to do, they said, hey, why don't you two adults play one-on-one, and then we'll just watch you, which again, if there's one thing that children love, it's watching adults do something and not participating themselves.
Right.
So it's just like, ooh, sure, that sounds fun and flirty and whatnot. And oh, they start off by saying, my friends say that I'm fun deficient. And her one friend is her sidekick, who's played by Alex Borstein from Family Guy.
Yes.
And Alex Borstein is fucking going for it. In her mind, this is a movie about a horny sidekick who just can't get enough of those hunky men. And all that, you know, that kitty cat magic in the background is important. So they're playing and she's realizing she has these amazing skills, but they're also kind of making out. So it's kind of like Lumbada basketball. And these kids are watching these two adults get really horny for each other and rub their bodies up against each other and do like crazy, you know, wire foo movements playing basketball. Oh my God. And again, somebody looked at this fucking scene and said, this is a good scene that belongs in $100 million. Like, this is not idiotic. This is not an insult to everyone. This doesn't make no sense on any level. This is good and it belongs in our motion picture.
Well, and on top of that, on top of how absurd the entire scenario is, it's also like the case study, right, for how Pitoff stages a scene, right?
Oh my God. Because
if you, yeah. This is my first time watching Catwoman. I'm just fresh off of it. But I had seen the basketball scene several times before because it's on YouTube. Go look for it. And it's got like Taken sequel levels of editing where it's just like every single, like five frames is a different shot and like everything's on these like low angle camera tilts and everything, and like these really aggressive close-ups, like looking straight at the camera. It's very, very strange, including like weird little moments when like Benjamin Brad is like wiping sweat off his brow so he can show off his six-pack and his shirt. The entire movie is like that, where every establishing shot is this overwrought crane shot, and everything's all sweeping and everything's covered in this like Trumpian orange glow.
Well, it makes sense that he was a visual effects guy before he became a visionary motion picture director, because this is a film that feels like it was shot on green screen.
Yeah.
It has a feeling like everybody is airbrushed. Everybody has been, the wrinkles are all that, which kind of makes sense in terms of the theme of the movie. But also it just feels like nothing has any dirt, nothing has any substance, nothing has any weight. And I understand that for when Catwoman is being Catwoman, because she has supernatural abilities. She can't do that without those kinds of things. But it's kind of like, you know, the first Spider-Man, where, you know, Roger Ebert complained, deservedly so, that, you know, you have Tobey Maguire, and he is a human being with weight and shadows and stuff, and then he turns to Spider-Man, and he's a fucking cartoon. And with this, whenever Halle Berry, you know, starts to do her Catwoman stuff, she turns into a fucking cartoon. But that's kind of the way it is otherwise as well. Everybody kind of feels like, yeah, that they've been airbrushed to a place of being completely antiseptic.
I point out once again that this movie was released in the early 2000s, which was right around the time of like the Matrix sequels, the first couple of Harry Potter movies. Yeah. All these times when we were toying around with the idea of having fully CG people in action scenes and like just trusting the effects to look realistic enough. And boy, does it not age well. And they lean into it with Catwoman. Like that whole final shot is just her CG her, and it looks plastic, it has this weird sheen to it, and again, like you said, it sort of accidentally brushes up against the subplot of like an evil makeup company trying to make you look flawless and beautiful, but at a terrible cost.
Well, and there's something kind of fascinating and sad and interesting and poignant about casting Sharon Stone.
Yeah.
Who is, you know, a great beauty who, as she got older, you know, the roles were less and less available there, because if your great calling card is that you are a stunning beauty, as you get older, that will weaken and weaken and weaken. And with it, your earning potential, your value to society, you know, the esteem in which you're held by your partner. I mean, it's a very sad, very tragic thing. So to cast her as the face of this evil company that will do anything to stave off the horrors and the ravages of aging and time and death and all those things. But then to just have her give such a one-dimensional, over-the-top, hammy, nuance-free performance. And nobody is good here. There is not a single good performance. Not only is there not a good performance, like, it's impossible. It feels like even if Halle Berry was inclined to give a really good performance or an interesting performance or, like, a gutsy performance, like, it couldn't have happened. And one of the things that makes her really, really wrong for Catwoman is... Halle Berry seems like a very nice woman. She seems lovely. Yeah. She seems like she has her voice is very soft. Her persona is very soft. She has
a wonderful appealing, beaming smile. Yeah,
exactly. And you need darkness. You need edge. You need some kind of danger. I mean, even the sexuality, which they really go overboard. I mean, it doesn't feel like they chose like an audacious new costume for Catwoman. It feels like they went to a Halloween store and they got a sexy cat lady costume. Not even officially bootleg sexy cat lady costume. Yeah. That was half off, both in terms of being half as expensive, and also there's only half as much of it as there should be, because it literally is just like this sexy bondage costume that I'm guessing works pretty well and that, you know, you can, it's not too constricting or anything. But again, it kind of just makes her look like a stripper who's constantly delivering, like, canned one-liners that are very painful.
Right, and just like with Venom, like, they can't really decide how far to take the anti-hero thing. Because for a hot second, when she first starts to become Catwoman, because there is that sort of transitional outfit that she has, like, when she first puts on, like, the leather outfit that was, weirdly enough, like, Chekhov's leather outfit they set up in the first act.
That's true. Have we talked about the... did you notice the scene in which she stops all of the jewel thieves? Partially by riding one of them like a skateboard.
Yes, I do remember this.
That's something that, again, somebody signed off on. There was a thing in the screenplay saying she jumps on one of these bad guys, and using her incredible magic kitty cat power, she rides him like a fucking skateboard.
It was very
rad.
Across
the room. Oh, my, and again, just the Eartha Kitt impersonation of being like, oh, you're trying to steal some jewels.
Perfect.
What a perfect idea. And again, just the mythology that they do with the cats is really hilariously over the top. The opening credits is like establishes that cats are a thing that exists in the world.
Yeah.
And there have always been cats. Exactly. Cats. And then later, when Halle Berry's trying to figure out what's going on with her, she literally Googles cats in history.
Yes, cats.women.
Those two things are not... And then she meets a magical, crazy cat lady.
Played by Frances Conroy, the most cat lady character actor to ever be created, so...
And you know what? You know what? You know what? The distinctive feature about her... She's got a cat named Midnight. That's the name of my jazz album from 1974. That's also the name of my club.
Yeah, who's like a resurrected version of the panther goddess Bast. So like that brings it around to Black Panther too?
Yeah, pretty much. And then again, this is how sad things are. If you look very, very, very closely, she like shows a bunch of images of Catwoman throughout history.
Yeah.
And as I guess what would be called an Easter egg. I'm not sure if the phrase existed at that point 14 years ago. One of the images...
Easter hadn't been invented yet, so no.
That's true. One of the images is of Michelle Pfeiffer as Catwoman in Batman Returns. And this is an illustration of a time when...
a literal illustration.
A performance as a photograph in the background upstages the lead performance in Catwoman. Because, yeah, it fucking made me so, so, so nostalgic for Michelle Pfeiffer's Catwoman, which is, again, such a great, 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 great character and just makes this look so much more terrible by comparison. I think part of what's wrong with this is I think they kind of feel like, okay, the last two Batman movies were really campy, and that's fun. You know, the Batman series was campy. You know, the kind of the Fantastic Four movies were kind of campy. Like, let's do campy. But their idea of campy is intentionally stupid and intentionally bad. And that's not camp. I mean, I guess that's a form of camp, but that's not good camp. I mean, a lot of camp is intentionally cheesy, intentionally silly, intentionally dumb. It's not intentionally bad in a way that doesn't necessarily say anything beyond the fact that the people who wrote and directed this and acted in it and were the crew people had no fucking idea what they were doing.
Yeah, I think one reason why Pitoff only has one name is because I'm pretty sure he's a space alien, because so much of this movie feels like it's an outsider looking into human society. Just the way everyone behaves and everything.
Yeah, well, somebody who's like surprised, who just recently observed that like cats exist. And they're like amazed by that. And like cats seem to have a weird, important relationship with, yeah. with women, too.
So
like,
these cats, what do they do exactly?
Holy fucking God. So yeah, I mean,
this wing whips, yes?
Well, and the thing that, one of the many, many things that sucks about this is because this was a superhero movie with a black female protagonist, I think Hollywood looked at this and said, ooh, boy, there just isn't a market for, you know, superhero movies starring women or superhero movies starring black people, which is, of course, super fucking idiotic and very, very wrong. And I think probably, you know, kept those kind of movies from hitting theaters for a couple of years, while with Hollywood being very, very afraid and pretty racist and sexist and looking for any kind of validation that all people really want are white men doing white men things.
They only learned that lesson this year.
Yeah. But here's the thing. Do you think there will be another Catwoman movie, or do you think this has kind of ruined the character for film, at least, if not on television?
I think it has, because there is a Catwoman right now, technically, on that terrible Gotham show, but I haven't watched it in forever seasons. So, I mean, technically, there is some like screen version of Catwoman happening, but I do wonder if this has sort of ruined... The reputation is just so tainted. The last major version of Catwoman we got was Anne Hathaway. Yeah, Dark Knight Rises,
I thought she was totally respectable. I thought she did a totally fine job with that. But I think part of that was that the water was tainted by that.
Yeah.
And I felt like there was two things where, like, yeah, you couldn't either... You can't live up to Michelle Pfeiffer, and you cannot live down Halle Berry.
Right. You always exist in this weird middle ground that you can never really break out of.
Totally. Well, and Anne Hathaway totally existed comfortably and enjoyably in that middle ground in The Dark Knight, and nobody fucking remembers her, even though she gave a very solid performance, and she's Anne Hathaway.
Right. And I just think the Catwoman works best as a supporting character because, like, she exists as she's a great foil for Batman, but who was her foil in this? Because it was Benjamin Bratt.
But to think towards, like,
and to be fair, Benjamin Bratt is an extremely sexy man.
Yes. But
he's trying his best.
He's so fucking... He's not... I feel like he's not trying as well. I feel like he's just coasting on being a handsome guy who doesn't have to do anything other than be handsome and smile and seem like he wants to have sex with Halle Berry.
Most of his performance is a leather jacket.
Exactly. All three of those things he pulls off just fine. But again, it's kind of fascinating. And it was 14 fucking years ago. I kind of feel like this was sort of a dead end.
Yeah,
I'd be interested to kind of talk about the superhero movies that didn't have sequels. I guess you know, those by definition or reboots or anything like that. The other thing about stuff like the Green Hornet. Which we'll probably get around to talking about at some point.
It's inevitable.
That's a weirdly fascinating, unfascinating... I mean, it was fucking directed by Michel Gondry and written by Seth Rogen. Yeah.
And starring Seth Rogen.
Exactly. And if they come out with another superhero movie, that one might end up getting in the mix for controlling the
Clint. Well, let's talk about you know, because one of the cool things about Michelle Pfeiffer's Catwoman was there was this little feminist streak in it.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Empowered, you know? Well, she owns her sexuality, you know? But again, with that, it's just like it. When your sexuality is literally like her shaking her booty on the basketball court, like in front of these mesmerized school children and Benjamin Bratt, like, again, that's not empowering. That's just kind of tacky and, you know, dress up sexy for Halloween, which is the whole vibe here.
Well, and especially when thinking about who would be a good villain for like a girl power Catwoman. I know, an evil makeup company. Ladies love makeup. And so that felt regressive too. And like, I mean,
I just want a man. I just love to have sex. Boy, is her doctor cute? I'm so man crazy.
It's definitely a dude's idea of what feminism is like. Like, it's this very lipstick feminine that also just so happens to sexually arouse the man writing it.
Oh, yeah.
So there is that. And it's just very reductive and very, very dumb. And I just did not like it. poor Sharon Stone. I wish she could have been given more to do. That was supposed to be a bit of a comeback for her. It was the first time she had like acted in something prominent in a while. But
I don't know that the phrase acted applies to what she does.
Appeared.
That's interesting. Apparently, Halle Berry accepted her Golden Raspberry. Winning this, which I don't know whether that's a masochistic gesture or whether that's an admirable gesture. What do you think?
I think it goes back to what we said before about Halle Berry just being a really nice person, probably.
Yeah.
It's just her, you know? And she's
you
like,
gave
you know,
me an award. Thank you so much.
Hooray, hooray. Or just, and just like owning it, just being like, I knew how crap, because you can kind of, so you can sniff the contempt for the role that she has while she's doing it, I think. I think there's a certain like above it-ness that she has towards this, which I don't blame her for.
Yeah, well, I mean, again, I think everybody was acting for a paycheck. I don't think anybody felt passionately about this, which is a shame, because I'm guessing there are a lot of people who would love to make a Catwoman movie.
Yeah.
And could do a good job, who feel like this intense emotional connection to the character. And I don't think it's a coincidence that this was directed by a man and written largely by dudes.
Yeah. Yep. Man sandwich, 12 o'clock. I believe exactly. Alex Borstein says at one point. Oh, and she tells Halle Berry to go give him some brown sugar at some point. And the ultimate one-liner where Sharon Stone thinks she's got Catwoman on the ropes and says game over. And then Catwoman flips up into the rafters and says, guess what? It's overtime.
Oh, yeah, baby.
Yeah. And, you know, stuff about how freedom is power, but they still need to be sexy. Yeah, this is a dire, dire movie, but I'm so glad I watched it because it is pretty bad shit. Like the whole Cirque du Soleil sequence when she's like temporarily spooked for a second whenever she goes on stage. She's like, how do I evade these people on trapezes? wild stuff.
That movie was astonishingly.
Yes. Oh, and the time she has to save a little boy on a carnival ride in broad daylight, and then it still takes Ben Bratt forever to figure out that she's Catwoman.
Oh God! Like when he like looks at their handwriting.
Yes.
Then he goes to a fucking handwriting expert, and he's like, "Ooh, these are two different people. One was timid, repressed, mousy, the sort of person who would be working unhappily at a cosmetic surgery. The other is sexy, empowered, confident, the sort of person who would conduct a series of jewelry crimes, using her heightened cat-like powers, almost as if some sort of superhero or supervillain."
But keep in mind, this is not an exact science.
Exactly. It's like those lie detectors. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
You get into it, but you get out of it.
I will say, I wish I had Patience's haircutting skills, where she just like takes two clippers and like crash zooms in on her, and she's like, in a perfect like early 2000s updo. That's like the spiky updo kind of thing.
I like too that they kind of, because again, how do you turn maybe the most beautiful woman in the world into a mousy nobody? Is you give her an unflattering outfit, and then her hair is kind of a mess. And then
yeah, a little
boom,
bit.
All they have to do is they do their, you know, Superman ducking into a phone booth by giving Halle Berry the Halle Berry cut that she is famous for and is synonymous with her.
Now, as bad as this movie is, I feel like she always sort of gets a bad rap, too, in the X-Men movies as Storm. Who do you think she's worse at playing? Is it Catwoman or Storm? Which is the bigger waste of her talents?
I would say that she's more boring and stock and generic as Storm, whereas she's actively terrible and Catwoman. Yeah. She gives like a really, she goes in for it. You know, she's like very big and very broad. And there's also like nothing but her in this movie.
Yeah.
Whereas in the X-Men movies, she's kind of, despite the incredible significance of the character in the comics, she's not that important generally. She's just kind of like one of a million characters.
Yeah. She loses herself in the ensemble a little bit.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a real, real shame. So yeah, I think that's pretty much it for Catwoman. Until the next terrible Catwoman adaptation, we'll see what happens. Let's move on. Okay, now from one cartoon to another. Nathan, what made you decide to have us watch Hulk Hogan's Rockin' Wrestling?
Well, I'm kind of morbidly fascinated by wrestling in general. I think it's kind of attributable to a couple of different things, one of which is I like this podcast called, doesn't exist anymore, called Wrestling with Depression. That's by a wrestling fan and comedian and depressive named Marty DeRosa. That was really, really good. I was on there a couple of times in my pre-podcasting days. And then wrestling is incredibly important in the world of Insane Clown Posse. Juggalos, you know, Violent J and Shaggy Two Dope both kind of started out as wrestlers, and they've dabbled in wrestling, and they have their own wrestling league. So I've always just been kind of fucking fascinated by that. And then also, I think part of it was, Jesus, when I saw that movie with you, was it
Mr. Nanny. Yeah, back when you were in Chicago, and we talked about it live for a wrestling charity podcast marathon.
We did indeed. And I think during that moment, I'm kind of fascinated by Hulk Hogan. I feel like he's kind of a secretly sort of like a Neil Breen. or a Tommy Wiseau type figure, where he's made so many glaringly terrible movies, like good, bad movies worth seeing. That I was kind of fascinated by that. And then I saw that he had a cartoon in the 1980s called Hulk Hogan's Rock and Wrestling at the very height of his popularity. And I love listening to We Hate Movies, and I'm a patron, and one of their features for Patreon is called Animation Damnation. And what they do is they look at a terrible, terrible cartoon from the 1980s to the 1990s, and they talk about it. And I fucking love that. And I'm like, oh man, I hope they do Hulk Hogan Rock and Wrestling. And I'm like, ah, fuck it, I should do it myself. oh god, and I just love the, one second, let me go look up Hulk Hogan Rock and Wrestling here.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I will tell you some of the plots sure. that got me completely intoxicated. So yeah, so when I saw that was on YouTube, I thought, okay, this is a way in which I can watch something that's only 22 minutes long and yeah. get a total article out of it. So that was part of it, and part of it also, like, I just want to experience this bullshit cheesiness, and I fucking did, and it was kind of amazing. It was kind of gave me everything that I wanted out of it.
Right. And I mean, it's part of that school. It was one of like several cartoons of the time that were like be real life figures that kids loved.
Oh,
like,
usually yeah, yeah. From well, sports pro, and pro wrestling. Stars. Like, Pro Stars was a huge one.
Yeah, because it was like was that the Michael Jordan one? Yeah.
Yeah. And it's funny too, because if it were realistic, it would just be them trying to, you know, get sleep with groupies without their wives finding out, them trying to gamble, like trying to do all of these illegal, immoral things and getting away with it. But here are some of the summaries of the plots that you will find. Yeah. The television show Hulk Hogan's Rock and Wrestling, which aired for two seasons, 1985 and 1986.
Well, should we set up like what the series is about? Because it's about Hulk Hogan, and he has his own group of wrestlers that are the faces, and then there's like a heel group of wrestlers led by Rowdy Roddy Piper, and they get into various adventures, yes. Right? Yeah.
They do indeed. And again, it's kind of, you know, I loved wrestling when I was 10 years old when this aired. And I think I probably watched this during its first run. I would watch it with my dad. And yeah, it was just kind of made for children. And you're kind of, I think the way I thought about wrestlers was kind of the way that this show ends, where I thought, oh, they must all hang out together. Yeah. They must all live together. They all must be best friends. The rivalries and friendships that they have on the show, they must have in real life as well. So yeah, again, it feeds into, and one of the things that was kind of tricky about making a wrestling themed animated show was that characters were always changing alliances, and they were always changing from good guy to bad guy. So, and it took a very long time to produce these shows. So by the time an episode aired, a good guy might actually now be a bad guy might now be a good guy, characters who hate each other are now friends. So that's kind of fascinating to me. And yeah, the good guys include Andre the Giant, who I think was a bad guy for part of his career. So yeah, here are some of the summaries of Hulk and Hogan's Rock and Wrestling. A horse shows up and causes trouble for the wrestlers. The wrestlers have a costume party, and a real gorilla shows up to rob the safe.
You don't say.
The Iron Sheik teaches his nephew's baseball team to cheat to win the Junior World Series. The Iron Sheik has a difficult time passing his driving test.
That was a busy episode for the Iron Sheik, I think.
Oh, this is a good one. An alien robot lands in the junkyard, and the wrestlers rush to help him get back home before the government can get him. And
it's just the Iron Giant.
I will tell you, that's true, that totally is the Iron One. And this is the one that we watched, that we wrote about. I forced you to watch this. I apologize for that. Sorry, not sorry. Sorry, not sorry, dude. It originally aired October 18th, 1986. Ooh, this is good. It's a cinematic reference. I'm sure Tom Wolfe felt very flattered by this. The wrong stuff. Hulk Hogan.
Kids loved the right stuff.
Exactly. Hulk, but they loved the Tom Wolfe's novel, a nonfiction novel.
Oh, yeah, yes, you know, of course.
They thought, you know, the adaptation wasn't as good, but still pretty solid.
They could take or leave Ed Harris, but that novel.
Pretty much. So it's Hulk Hogan and Nikolai Volkoff are sent into space to rescue astronauts.
Oh, man. Yeah, and why'd you pick this one?
Because it's the only one available on YouTube, and it sounded funny.
Yeah, and you sold it to me as because I'm a huge sci-fi nerd. Which, by the way, one quick thing I forgot to mention about Catwoman. I also gleaned some pleasure out of recognizing all the Vancouver-based supporting players in that from various episodes of Stargate SG-1. So, tip of the hat.
Nerd.
But back to Hulk Hogan's Rock and Wrestling. Yes, I was impressed. I was blown away by the scientific accuracy of the wrong stuff. So the premise is, like, at first, they're just hanging out on some old lady's farm helping her out.
Granny. They're helping Granny. Come on.
Fine.
She has a name.
Granny.
And they're helping her out because there's no better way to exercise than through farm chores. Right. Hulk Hogan says as much. Come on, are you not listening to what he says?
Granny, there's no better exercise than farm chores, dude.
Hulk Hogan, by the way, voiced not by Hulk Hogan, but by Everybody Loves Raymond's Brad Garrett.
Yeah.
Deborah! They just yell all your lines as flatly and affectlessly as Hulk Hogan would. And he's like, I got it, dude.
And call everybody dude. Begin every letter with dude.
Hulk Hogan didn't even do that. He called everyone brother.
That is true. That is true.
Already the strings are being cut.
Hey, you can't ask the writers of Hulk Hogan's Rock and Wrestling to actually walk Hulk Hogan or Rock or Wrestling.
Yes.
So they're all doing farm chores and they all want to watch the big World Series baseball game.
Yes.
So they want
all big baseball fans, the wrestlers. Mm-hmm.
And Granny says, "Nah, you can't watch none of the TV in my house." And again, she completely emasculates all of these buff macho wrestlers.
Like, well, I guess we just have to do what Granny tells us. We can't go against her. We're all beta cucks.
Speaking of beta cucks, so then they go to the barn. And they try to change the channel, but the chickens are all watching animals on the TV. And when Captain Lobetto tries to change the channel, he is physically defeated by a pig.
But you know what? That's why representation is important. Sometimes animals want to see themselves represented on TV, okay?
That is true. That is true. I hadn't really thought about that. And this is all that incredible. This is all a non sequitur. This is all incredibly pointless.
Yeah.
It's all like just so
they needed to fill 5 minutes at the top of the
episode.
Exactly.
So what we discover is that they're aliens. I've got Venom on the brain here. Astronauts are stuck in outer space and they need. Astronauts can't go up there. They need the two strongest men in the world.
In a vacuum, in space where there's no gravity. It doesn't matter how strong you are. It blows my mind. It makes me so angry.
Are you saying that's not realistic?
Why aren't these writers of Saturday morning cartoons paying attention to the laws of physics, I ask you?
So the news anchors delivering some exposition, they say, oh, you know, it will take the two strongest men on Earth. I said, well, why don't they do it with the robot arm? They say, scientists have discovered it can't be done with robots.
So you know the shuttle, right? And they're in the cargo bay. So it's these two astronauts in their spacesuits, and they can't pry the cargo bay door open. Get back in the fucking cabin.
Yeah.
You can get into the cabin from the cargo bay.
So what we learn from these newscasters is that basically
it's like getting locked in your garage and not being able to get inside the back door to your house.
It's like Apollo 13 meets Armageddon. Basically. Yes. So what we discover is what they need to do is they need to find the two strongest men in the world. They need to test him. They need to train him. They need to send him into outer space so that he can rescue these two astronauts. And they all have to do this within a 24-hour period.
Yes.
24 hours. Oh, my goodness. That to me seems very medically inaccurate or scientifically inaccurate. So what you do is you have all of the wrestlers competing against each other. With, again, some of these things that I don't think makes a lot of sense. Like,
why bother with a competition if there's 24 hours? Just pick somebody.
Exactly. But this being, you know, a thing, they end up with a Hulk Hogan from the Americans, the Nikolai Volkov from the Russians. And this has what I think is one of the most wonderfully 1980s moments of all of the 1980s. And that is Ronald Reagan. Well, they don't say
He
calls up. Mammy. He says, Hulkster, everybody's depending on you. You gotta save humanity.
You got it, buddy.
It's Ronald Reagan with Jimmy Carter's hair, which is weird.
Pretty much. And he says, when I get back, we're gonna tag team Bubba the Lunch Bunch's wife.
Whoa, phrasing.
And then...
hold on, Gipper.
And then the other one is Nikolai Volkov. And you might not have remembered this because you're a lot younger than I am. But there was this thing in the 1980s called the Cold War. There was a battle between communism and capitalism. And the main way that it was being fought was in children's cartoons.
Gotcha.
And this is one that illustrated that Nikolai Volkoff is very, very stupid. And not only that, but like the Gipper, he loves Hulk Hogan. He gives him a pep talk. The Russian premier, oh, let me tell you, he says, hey, you jerk, you better save us. Oh, my goodness. It's ugly. It illustrates that, you know, the United States is preferable to the Soviet Union, and capitalism will conquer communism in any case.
Indeed, indeed. Suck it, Gorbachev. So yeah, so the first whole half of the episode, like after the farmhouse antics that are in a completely different realm, they do like the contest, which is just full of like, again, that montage in Armageddon where they're like testing all these undisciplined nobodies and like there are people running on a riding an exercise bike.
The evil wrestlers all use dirty tricks.
Yes, that's right.
Fool, not unlike they would do in the ring, only in this case they're using dirty tricks.
Well, this time like, lives are at stake.
If we're thinking about it, this is like one of the most Christ-like things you can possibly do is to go into outer space to try and save somebody, knowing that you will probably die in the effort. Like, why are all these evil people competing to martyr themselves for the sake of the United States space program?
Right. Like, it's just a pure ego boost, I guess. They're just like, well, we can't have them winning. We can't have them dying honorably. And then, yeah, they do the breath tests and stuff. And eventually, yeah, like you said, it's Hulk and Nikolai, and they get the calls, and then they get in the spaceship. But wouldn't you know it, the pilots aren't on board.
Oh, and then we also forgot the part where Roddy Piper tries to sabotage this space. Oh, I think they tried to like get in and like, because again, they also wanted to. Anyway, so it's established that they knock out the pilots so that Nikolai Volkoff and Hulk Hogan also have to pilot this space shuttle in addition to everything else.
They want to kill their friend.
I'm calling bullshit. They're going to fucking die. It's going to be just like Challenger. This came out in 1986. I think there probably should have been some version where this was like Challenger, except with Hulk Hogan and Nikolai Volkoff.
Oh, God. Instead, it's
kind of the darkest moment in cartoon history.
It's just a shitty version of Gravity now. But, Armageddon. Yeah.
It's very much Armageddon.
It's both of them combined, I suppose. But yeah, so they go up into space, and oh man, it's just such a weird
thing. Let's talk about
some
of the gags.
Nikolai
Volkoff thinks that Mission Control is an in-flight movie.
Right.
He confuses the controls for his space shuttle with the controls for a video game, which makes me wonder how he managed to score in the top two of all of these wrestlers if he's so stupid he doesn't understand the basic fundamentals of space travel.
And then there's the bit with the food that is very much packaged like Earth food and not like space food.
That is true.
Like with the banana and all the cherries and stuff. I'm like, is it a Pac-Man game? Like, what is going on here?
I think so, yes.
Like, there's no Tang, nothing's in a bag, it's just loose produce, like, set off in this space shuttle with no gravity.
Well, another thing that I love, too, is kind of implementing all of the cornerstones of professional wrestling into outer space. They call each other a bunch of space-themed insults.
Yes.
My three favorite being space garbage, meteor mouth, and crater face.
Oh,
this
yes.
is the only time in which they try insult each other in specifically space themed ways.
Yeah, well, they needed to have them be especially cutting, and they know that context is everything when it comes to their insults in space.
Somebody were to call me space garbage, I don't think I'd be able to respond.
Well, you know, some call me the space cowboy.
I call you the pompous of love.
They end up saving the guys, right?
They do.
Yeah,
they don't die. It's not a Challenger type situation.
No one explodes.
No. They'll explode with laughter watching this cartoon.
Whoa! But yeah, they make it down safe, and oh god, what else happens? Oh, when they get back down, they have like the follow-up calls or whatever. Oh no, yeah, Nikolai gets a call from the premiere and says, what is it?
He says, can you do me one more thing for Mother Russia? Shut up!
Is it Mario Van Peebles from Jaws the Revenge? Is that you? I love that Mean Gene Okerlund was there at Cape Canaveral to see them down. Like, what was his job?
Well, like, no, even like Mean Gene Okerlund, whose literally only job is to like talk into a microphone. Like, ooh, we can't have you in this thing. It actually reminded me of, apparently for the real Ghostbusters. Ernie Hudson auditioned for the Ernie Hudson role, and lost to Arsenio Hall.
Oh, God. The poor man.
And Ernie Hudson's amazing. Ernie Hudson's got a great voice. He's hilarious. He totally should. Yeah, I mean, obviously, Arsenio Hall did a pretty good job, and it's very iconic, but it's pretty sad when you audition to play the voice of yourself and you lose to a different person.
It was really weird when
Brad Garrett probably as good at doing Hulk Hogan's voice as Hulk Hogan would have been.
It's true, but it was very weird in the real Ghostbusters when Ernie Hudson's character started going whoop whoop whoop.
That is true.
Yeah, so that was very strange when Winston started doing that. So yeah, that ends that episode of Hulk Hogan's Rock and Wrestling. This is just a weird little like 80s artifact of a time in it reminds me of when we talked about Mac and Me, and yeah, I think we both wrote pieces on Mac and Me this year, like, and I specifically wrote one about like the way Reagan era deregulation of the FCC like led to these kinds of shows that were just like marketing things. Like, I'm sure there were like Hulk Hogan toys related to this stuff too. Like, it was all just like a racket to advertise the brand of this thing. Well, and so before we end this, then we should talk about the theme, like the intro sequence.
Oh, cool. It's funny that you mentioned that. Talk about everything connecting and themes and things and circles and circles and circles. The theme is written by Jim Steinman, who is one of the greatest American songwriters of all time. You are probably most familiar with his compositions for the musician and actor Meatloaf. Yes. That's right. This motherfucker wrote Bat Out of Hell. He wrote Back Into Hell. He wrote Total Eclipse of the Heart. He was a fucking genius. And he is the subject of the latest entry in The Weird According to Al.
Nice.
Which is Al did a Jim Steinman pastiche stop called Stop Forwarding That Crap to Me. That is really fucking hilarious. And just the whole idea of, you know, using that kind of big bombastic, you know, rock and roll, melodramatic musical theater storytelling to, you know, whine about people sending you obnoxious unwanted emails. So that was pretty awesome that Jim Steinman did that. And then the other theme song that Hulk Hogan had, Real American, I believe Rick Derringer wrote and recorded. And Rick Derringer, as you all know, produced a lot of Al's early albums. So no matter where you are in the world of Hulk Hogan music, Weird Al is right behind you.
No, of course. But like even the intro sequence itself, like that,
yeah,
it's set
it's
to
Hulk,
like there's
Hulk,
it's
Hulk, 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 Hulk.
But also and, like live action Steinman, Hulk yeah. walking down that like that thing, and I just think it's so telling. Like it feels like that's the final shot of the intro sequence captures why Hulk Hogan wanted to make the show, and it's this aerial shot of just like Hulk being like surrounded by throngs of his own fans. Like
well,
that's
he's
what's supposed
a,
to sell the thing, you know?
He's a mulleted bandana wearing Jesus,
yeah,
being mobbed by his. He's kind of like, you know, the lead character at the end of Perfume. You know, being torn apart by people who worship him just a little bit too much. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was. I got exactly what I wanted from those 22 minutes of my life.
Yeah,
and truth be told, I would probably watch other episodes with my son.
Patrons, if you want to give us more money, if we hit a particular goal, maybe we do like an episode by episode Hulk Hogan's Rock and Wrestling.
That works for me. Let's get it going, people. Come on, dudes.
Let's make it
happen.
Let's move on. All right, now it's time for podcast recommendations. Nathan, what do you recommend this week?
Well, this one cuts very close to home for me. This is a podcast that I've been doing for the last 10 months or so. It's called Nathan Raven's Happy Cast.
Sounds
it's got
neat.
This guy, Clint Worthington, on it, who I really, really like, and I think he's great, and he doesn't get enough attention or praise or validation or money. I think he deserves a lot more money for this podcast that he does, because I really like it. I relate to both of the dudes on it. It's pretty funny. You know, it's pretty emotional sometimes. One of the guys is always stammering and sounds like he's constantly doesn't know what he has to say. And I relate to that guy very, very well. I come to feel like I am that man. And it's only over 2 weeks. So, you know, you're not overwhelmed with the sheer volume of this wonderful podcast that I called Nathan Raven's Happy Cast.
I will be sure to check that out and contribute to their Patreon and send them mailbag questions and rate and review them on iTunes.
I contribute to their Patreon. I'm not ashamed to say that. I believe in their products so, so strongly that I kick in $5 a month to those good folks.
Nice. Putting your money where your own mouth is. Well, I will second that and also raise you my recommendation, because I've started to like listen to a lot more podcasts, basically for this segment. I've started to do a lot more things like Dr. Death, like Gladiator, like short form true crime stuff.
Oh, that one's great too. I've been loving that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so the one I'm listening to right now is actually Rachel Maddow has a new one called The Bag Man. That's kind of a serial-esque look at Spiro Agnew's rise and fall of the whole like racketeering, like the bribery, corruption stuff around the same time as Watergate. And right now it's really, really interesting. I'm a big fan of Rachel Maddow. I think she's a really good, comprehensive, funny report, like pundit. And she brings a lot of great joie de vivre to the proceedings, but it's also really well produced. And, you know, there's, you know, pointed parallels to Trump, but not like hammering you over the head with it. It's just sort of like, huh, sure seems weird that there's this populist who runs on racist rhetoric who's like also ripping off the American people. But it's like a couple, three episodes in, and it's really solid. I think it's another sort of short form one, so you can kind of just like listen to it in probably 1 3- or 4-hour chunk in a few weeks once it wraps up. But yeah, that's the one I really enjoy.
Sweet. Well, I will check that shit out. And you should check out my recommendation.
Yes, I will. I'll try to listen to it if I have time, if I can do
that.
Right, I'm kind of busy editing this podcast and right. I've got and everything else.
I'm sorry. It's
all right, let's move on. All right, it's mailbag time. Once again, you can send us stuff at asknathanrabinshappycast@gmail.com, and we will read it on the air. This time, we don't have something from Lawrence. Well, we do, but we also have things from people other than Lawrence. I wanted to pick one out from Mark Rosenthal, who, by the way, Mark, thank you so much. You're always really like great about liking Elga Hollywood stuff, which is really nice. So I just want to let you know, I see you, just like the Na'vi in Avatar. He asks, well, he has two things for us. One, this show is rad as hell. Well, thank you, Mark. I agree. And I think Nathan does too, given that it is his recommendation. Yeah. Two, what would you paint on the side of your bitchin' metal van? I think this is in reaction to our discussion of Mandy. Nathan, what do you think?
My first inclination was to go with Mandy, because that really does seem like the sort of motion picture that should be captured for posterity in airbrushed form on the side of a totally rockin' metal van. That's a little bit too easy. So instead, I'm going to do my favorite obscure Sesame Street character, Frazzle, from the 1980s. And he was a very hard to understand and seemingly angry and frightening monster who actually just has this incredible yearning for love and validation and understanding. So I would be some sort of be Frazzle flying on a dragon with fire coming off of its wings.
Nice.
And it's very, very possible that I will get a sweet-ass van, and that is what I will get airbrushed on the side of it.
I'm going to keep my finger placed firmly on the pulse of pop culture, and I'm going to get Gritty painted on the side of my metal van.
I love
the new, the Philadelphia Flyers new...
That is awesome.
Antifa allied mascot. The terrifying, like, Elmo on bath salts. That he is.
I fucking love Gritty. Gritty is awesome.
Gritty is dope as fuck. And I think he would be a perfect recipient of a bitchin' metal van painting, possibly with the jersey, but with also like a sword held aloft on top of a mountain, like touching an eagle. Perhaps a Philadelphia eagle.
Sweet.
Yeah. So that's my pick. So thanks, Mark, for the question. We hope we gave you satisfactory answers. And if anyone wants to draw those for us, we will put it on the sides of our vans.
That's true. And I think Gritty punching Hitler would be a particularly good image.
Absolutely. In the style of the first Captain America issue, I would love it.
Exactly.
Let's move on. And let's close out with happy places. Nathan, what's your happy place?
I am going to vote tomorrow, and I'm very, very excited about that. I feel like that's kind of my happy place, and I'm very worried about our country. We've gone on a really bad, bad path. Things have been pretty grim for the last 2 years, but I hold out hope that if we come together and we vote for the right people, and we have some leaders who are not nightmare monsters from hell, the seemingly inexorable march towards doom and annihilation that we're on can be reversed and we can be saved, but we need to save ourselves. And we need to do that by voting for the right people tomorrow and just fucking voting. Vote, unless you're Republican, in which case don't vote. But vote if you're not going to vote for Republicans.
No, if you're a Republican, please, please vote. Please sure to get out the vote on Wednesday, November 7th.
Exactly.
Check your, just go to your nearest library or 7-Eleven. That is where you will be able
to
vote.
Be like Donald Trump Jr. And use all that information.
Yes, indeed. Funny enough, my happy place is that I already voted. I early Yay. Voted. Both Julia and I voted, I believe, last week at our polling place. We checked to make sure we were registered to vote. We did it. And actually, I mean, I feel bad that I haven't done more. I sort of wanted to make a point these last couple weeks to try to do phone banking and canvassing and stuff. And I didn't end up making time for that. But I did end up donating to a couple of swing reps and like senators and stuff that I really... that I really believe in, especially Claire McCaskill of Missouri, who's like the incumbent Democratic senator, a blue voice in a very, very red state, the state that I went to college in. So I was in college when she first got elected. She is absolutely not perfect by any means, but I think that's one thing that like Democrats need to learn is that like vote for people we're passionate about in the primaries. Whoever wins, though, we need to rubber stamp them. Like, even if as imperfect as Claire McCaskill is, she does have to compromise on a few things to be someone anyone in Missouri pays attention to. Like, the only reason she won last time is because her opponent was the legitimate rape guy. And that came out around that time. So Republicans didn't turn out. Yeah, I donated to that campaign and I believe in that. I mean, yes, she's imperfect, but we need her. We need all of them right now. We need to swing the House. It would be great to swing the Senate as well. Yeah, we just need those kinds of checks. So both Nathan and I say, if you want to be cool, go vote, brother.
Vote for the people Hulk Hogan wouldn't endorse.
Who won't give Peter Thiel youth blood. All right, that wraps up this episode of Nathan Raven's Happy Cast. It's always a pleasure to talk with you, especially about terrible superhero movies.
For sure. Until next time. Yes. Peace out, y'all.
Peace. Have brother. A perfect week. That's the only one I know. That's the only cat pun I know.
There we go.
That wraps it up for this episode of Nathan Rabin's Happy Cast. You can find me on Twitter at @AlcoHollywood and Nathan at Nathan Rabin. Subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes or your favorite podcatcher, and pledge to our Patreon at patreon.com/NathanRabin'sHappyCast. Our theme song is by John Beacon. Check out his stuff at johnbeacon.com. Until next time, I bid you a hearty whoop whoop.